Welcome to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton. Larissa Fasthorse is a playwright and a member of the Secheonghu Lakota Nation. Her plays combine drama and satire to portray Native American experiences. Larissa's work, called The Thanksgiving Play, is about a group of well-meaning white educators who are tasked with creating a politically correct school pageant about the first Thanksgiving. Larissa appeared at a virtual National Writer Series event. She spoke with Cynthia Canty, former host of Michigan Radio's Stateside. Larissa is a recent recipient of a MacArthur Foundation grant, or the so-called Genius Grant. Cynthia asked Larissa if it was true what she'd heard, that when the foundation called, Larissa didn't pick up, thinking it was a spam call.
I didn't answer like three times. They finally had to text me and tell me they needed to talk to me about something. And I assumed they wanted to hire me for, to consult about some Indigenous program or whatever. And so I was completely taken off guard. Absolutely.
I'm wondering, I don't often get to talk to someone who is a MacArthur Genius Grant recipient. What does this grant mean for you symbolically and practically?
Oh, wow. It means so many things. Practically, it means my bills are paid for at least 5 years, more than that, hopefully, because we're not planning to live crazy. But my bills are paid for 5 years in advance, which I've never experienced as an artist. I've never experienced more than 6 months that I knew we could pay our rent. So this is pretty incredible. And trying to figure out what that will mean for our creativity. I'm married to a sculptor, actually, his work's on the wall behind me. So what that's going to mean for our creativity, to take off that constant pressure just to make rent. I don't know how that's going to be. I haven't experienced it yet. I'm really excited. I think symbolically, it means a great deal, even more than I thought it would. I'm getting really cool invitations now to do cool stuff. I'm being asked to advise about national arts policy and do a lot of fun talks like this. And although we'd already planned to do this before that, and do a lot of really cool things already that I wasn't offered before. So it's exciting just to see where it leads and what sort of creativity it will open for me.
Doors are open and financially you'll get some breathing space. That has got to be just amazing. The Thanksgiving Play, it was one of the 10 most produced plays in 2019, but you've said that you consider this your most depressing success. Why is that, Larissa?
I wrote this play because I had kind of reached a ceiling in theater where, I was making my living, it was what I did as my job, but I just couldn't get past that multiple production place. So my plays would get maybe two productions. I think once I got three and that's it. And so the reason I was told again and again by theaters was that it was casting. My plays were called uncastable, even one that had only one half Native American character in it. And I was like, okay, I was just so fed up. And I said, fine, American theater. I know audiences want to hear about contemporary Indigenous stories. I know they want to see this work. So I'm going to create a play with four white presenting people in one room. If you can't cast and produce that, then we have another problem, right? And the good news is, I would say, I really love this play. It says all the things I want to say. It talks about all the issues I want to talk about. It makes people think in the way that I want my plays to make people think. But I did have to do it with four white presenting people, which is kind of a bummer. And I hope going forward in the future, that isn't the case.
At least you put out that dare card and you laid it down and theater took it. It's been produced.
They did.
I was real interested, Larissa, when I read that you wrote this work in Ireland, which certainly knows a few things about having its culture and its history and its land taken over by unwanted outsiders. Did the Nation of Poets and Writers leave its mark on you?
Oh, yeah, it definitely did. It was interesting because I did this in the first 10 days. I was at a retreat at Anna McCarrig, which is Tyrone Guthrie's wife's home, but they call it his home in the way of that time. The first few days I was hearing all the voices in with an Irish accent, which was not helpful because I'm trying to write about a very American holiday. So once I got that out of my head, it was really incredibly helpful because there were several people at this artist retreat with me that were original Irish. And so we got to talk a lot about what that experience is like for us here in the United States versus what it's like for them. And they're dealing with so many similar things where the dominant culture came in, being the UK came in and kind of packaged what they liked about original Irish culture and then sold it and made it a commodity that made that they could sell and looked interesting and you could put it on 100 belt buckles and whatever, you know. And they just picked and chose the things that they thought was interesting and marketable.
That yeah. really had and to so, resonate with you.
Yeah, it's like, absolutely. That's what we're dealing with all the time here. So I got a lot of feedback from those folks when we talk about the issues in the play and how it related to the original Irish folks. And it was super helpful and really interesting to have that feedback right there.
The Thanksgiving play takes aim at that mythology of the pilgrims and the Indians finding peace over a meal and Indians sharing and teaching white Europeans. You grew up in South Dakota. You're a member of the Lakota Nation. What did Thanksgiving Day, that Thanksgiving week, what did that mean to you and your family when you were growing up?
Yeah, you know, I'm really fortunate. I grew up in a time that was called the Era of Reconciliation in South Dakota, where the state was trying to reconcile with Indigenous peoples. So like at school, we didn't have any of these plays, these little interstitial scenes that were represented in the play. None of these little pageants or whatever about pilgrims and Indians. For us, it was about harvest, which is very applicable in South Dakota, which is an agricultural state. It was about fall. It was about change of season. It was about gratitude and family and a lot of really fantastic things. So it's absolutely one of my favorite holidays because who doesn't love a whole day about gratitude? That's great. I really enjoy it.
You didn't have that mythology narrative that so many Americans grew up with. What did you feel when you started researching and digging and you kind of learned what that myth was?
Yeah, it was shocking. I was actually just looking for, I don't remember what, but some factual thing because there's so many. So I was researching something and one of these shocking, you know, children's pageant pieces came up and I couldn't believe it was real and that it was now. I thought maybe it's a satire or something, but it was a real thing. And then I started looking specifically for them. And even that line where the teacher's comments, you know, I had my students say Injun instead of Indian. That's a real teacher's comment from 2013. I mean, it's not like it's super old or anything.
You know, I want to ask you about that. That one stuck in my mind. Oh, they love when we say engines. So that is the real thing. You did not have to exercise any poetic license for that.
No, that one I just took right from what a teacher said.
Do you think the teachers making up those songs like the 12 Days of Thanksgiving and that comment about, oh, my kids love when we say engines. Do you think they would be... Have they any awareness at how racist that is?
I don't know. I sincerely hope, I hope that they don't know. I hope that they're not aware and that, you know, it's, I would actually rather it be ignorance, I think, than, well, I don't know. I'm not sure if I'd rather it be ignorance or race, open racism. You know, I've often said I did a play called What Would Crazy Horse Do that involved the Klan. And I worked with some members of a particular branch of the Klan for like a year and a half to research for that play. And it was actually easier to work with them than a lot of like really well-meaning folk, but ignorant folk, because they're clear. I knew exactly where they stood. I knew what they were going for. There was no confusion. There's no wishy-washiness. We were very open and honest with each other. And I knew what was happening, where sometimes I feel like people, ignorance is really more dangerous because people are, especially well-meaning ignorance, right? Because people are trying so hard to not offend and to kind of go back and forth and you never know where you stand. And so you never get anywhere. And I hope. I hope they're not racist, but, you know, willful ignorance is kind of scary too.
Well, you know, you really do drill down on this issue of performative wokeness. And I was struck by a comment I saw in an interview with you. You said people being afraid of offending, you call that the biggest enemy of your career as a Native American woman. How do the well-meaning or the woke get it most wrong?
Wow. Yeah. I think one of the biggest ones that I'm seeing lately is believing they've done the work and they understand and that they're now here to teach you. And I mean, I have people do that to me. White folks do that to me all the time. Teach me about what it's like to be an Indigenous person. I'm like, wait, what? Because they have a friend now. And like, but they've done the work and they went to a bunch of seminars and classes and anti-racism training. And it's really fascinating how people do all, they start out meaning well, like they want to help other people, but then they end up just centering themselves again and putting themselves in the center. And that's pretty frightening. And they suddenly become the expert on everything. And I've seen that happening a lot lately with all the kind of anti-racism work and awareness we have building right now in this field. There's a lot of kind of scary centering of voices that maybe should not be the ones speaking for others.
You're echoing things that we heard all this year in this country during the Black Lives Matter issue. Like where do people who are not Indigenous or people who are not of color who want to be allies, where do they do it and how? I think is a stumbling block for folks. What do you think is a good way or a not good way for someone to be an ally?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the big one is to be able to listen, be willing to listen and be willing to understand that you may be, even if you are the well-meaning one and you are the one that's always tried to do it right, you still may have to hear some of the pain that people are dealing with, the terrible things that people say to us every day. I mean, I would say 80% of Thanksgiving play is actual dialogue taken from things people have said to me in my life, and not the worst. I mean, I've heard much worse. I was at a theater event a couple years ago, and well-meaning, big theater supporter, really prides herself on being a really liberal, you know, person. We'd been talking at a theater fundraiser, and she hadn't gotten my name in the beginning. At the end, she asked who I was, and I told her, and I said, yeah, I'm a playwright. She's like, oh, and you're Native American? I said, yeah. She's like, I never would have guessed. You're so well-spoken. Oh. And I was like, wow, okay, great. I'm glad we're in the same war here together. But, you know, she considers herself a really strong ally. And so, I mean, things like that happen all the time. And so don't do that.
But,
you know, do be willing to make a mistake. Do be willing to sometimes say the wrong thing and then fix it. And don't get defensive. Mm-hmm. Fix it. Change it. Listen. Listen to what people are telling you and do things differently.
And certainly voices like yours trying to express that message through theater. What is it about theater, do you think, is a good way to try to get your message of being aware of the Indigenous people's point of view? Why does theater work so well for that?
You know, honestly, theater was the world that was willing to do this. It was a place that, because I started in film and television, and film and TV was not interested in getting things right at that time, with about a dozen years ago. It was really about theater coming and saying to me, we want to do this and we want to do it right. So they were willing to give me the platform to speak in the way I want to. And they were very willing to accept the challenges that I put to theaters. I always put two challenges to every theater that works with me for on a new production, that I can't be the only Indigenous art in the season, and I can't be the only Indigenous person paid in the season. And I'm super excited about how theater took that on for my very first play and has really worked hard to fulfill those challenges and create new relationships, bring in lots of Indigenous audience members, providing accessibility, not just about money, but accessibility in the culture of our theaters, because the culture of theater is incredibly white. The culture of our spaces is mm-hmm. making all these assumptions based on white culture. And so the theater companies I work with have always been willing to change, to provide elder seating, to understand that we live in multi-generational families and we like that, and to allow multi-generational people to come and not place restrictions on who's allowed to come to my plays. It's been beautiful to see how open and willing theater is.
How has this play been received by the Native American communities?
It's been awesome. I've been so excited. The places where I've been, I mean, it's played dozens of places I haven't been, but the places where I've been, we've had such a fantastic time. The very first production actually was in Portland, Oregon, even though the world premiere is technically in New York City. Mm-hmm. And we had this huge like Native American night, and we had a local Native organization sponsored a big party. It was really exciting because when I'm in theater, let's be honest, and white people are the vast majority of our audiences in American theater. And to go into a predominantly white institution, which is where I was in Portland, it's not an Indigenous specific institution, and to be in an audience where almost the entire house was Native American was so exciting and so much fun. And no one laughs harder at the kicking heads than Native American people. I mean, you got to laugh or cry, and it's true, you know? So you got to go one way or the other. It's been great. Same thing, Playwrights Horizons, when we were in New York, we had this incredible, we had Native American nights, and then we also had this beautiful art installation that went through the lobby and into the theater that one Indigenous artist curated and had all these people submit from around the country. So people got to have these incredible experiences with Indigenous art, but also then, of course, the artists that we brought in. And we had all these other Indigenous, whenever we do my plays, we try to bring other Indigenous artists in, and we do readings with other writers, and so that they get connected to these theaters. And it's just really been exciting to have all these really cool experiences and events, spoken word, rap, marketplace, Native American marketplaces in the lobbies, all these different things have happened around this play, which has been really the best part of it to me.
That's wonderful. Joseph writes a question and he says, amazing work. I'm so glad I resisted the temptation to get to know this specific work before experiencing it. Mm-hmm. And he says to you, Larissa Fastor, you seem so equally adept at skewering our American whiteness history, elementary education, and the American theater kind of in one satirical swoop. Is there anything that brings you personal joy kind of in watching people maybe squirm or people become enlightened at an uncomfortable moment?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's the best for everybody, right? I mean, that awkward moment. I mean, if you're talking about comedy, which is what I'm doing, I'm doing a comedy within a satire. I mean, that moment of like, oh, they're totally about to step in it and you can see it coming and they do. And it's just, it's classic, you know, drama, comedic drama, right? And so I love all of it. I love it when I screw up all the time, you know, and I write it down because I'm going to use it later. I mean, that's, if we can't laugh, you know, again, you have to laugh or cry. If we can't laugh at our mistakes and then work to change them and then work to correct them, we're just doomed. We're not going to get anywhere. I personally don't want to go to theater and just be like given medicine. Like I want it to be fun. I want to go and enjoy myself and have fun, but I also want to learn and question and wonder about things. So.
Well, and Joseph's note is, you know, it's there's a long tradition of using theater as a weapon. Christine wants to know, what do you hope will change in American theater as a result of this pandemic? And I had wondered that too. When you stop and you think about what this last year has been like, theater's been hit. The biggies have been hit. The casts and crews of that, you know, Hamilton and Wicked and their home, the regional folks, the local theater companies. And I'm wondering, what do you think might come? Could there be a reset because of this time of the pandemic?
So just personally, I like to differentiate between the pandemic and the actual pandemic, which is a real thing that's killing people that I've suffered. My father's had it. My sister's had it. I've known many people have died. So that's one thing. Theater is related to, I think you're talking about the shutdown, which is a very different thing. And I would like to separate those because theater is an art form and a job. It is not life and death, which the pandemic is. And I don't want to put theater on the same level as that. So if you're talking about the shutdown, which I assume you mean, I just hope we survive. I hope that, you know, we are losing so many artists right now and technical workers and front of house workers and people. I mean, we're losing them. You know, they're retraining. They're going into other work. They're leaving the centers where their job was because their job has disappeared. And I think, you know, the biggest thing I just hope is that we can get them back. Because we're losing so many wonderful people that have poured their life into a field that they have so much passion for. And I just hope we're able to, you know, find a way to center the humans and bring them back. And I'd written about this earlier in the year that maybe next year, next fall, hopefully, when we're all back in the theater, we don't need to have a huge, crazy pyrotechnic, whatever, special effect, moving set, something. Maybe we need to just do something much smaller and pay a lot more people. And we need to sit in a circle and tell stories, maybe. Maybe we need to help each other heal in the best way that storytelling and theater can do. I hope that theater is healing when we return. I hope it's funny. I'd like to laugh for like the next 2 years. It's been a really rough pandemic for me and my family. And so I hope that theater is able to do all those best things in keeping us together and helping us heal.
And bringing us together physically, which is going to be so wonderful when that can happen. Catherine Mazur has a good question that actually echoes something I had wondered about, but I'm going to let her ask this question. And she said, Larissa, thank you for this play. My husband and I are both white K-12 educators. We're working hard to honor our responsibilities. So you hit home. If you could speak directly to teachers, and you are right now, what would you say?
Oh, I'd say educate yourself. Find out why things are missing from your curriculum. Don't just rely on the curriculum. Don't rely on the books they give you. Don't rely on white written material, you know, material written by the outsiders. Go directly to the source. Go to the people on whose land you are standing and find out who they are, if they're there or not, and if not, why, and if they are, get to know them. Find out how you and your students can be of service to those people. What do they need? What help can you provide? Make sure every single person, little person that you're responsible for in that classroom knows who those people are and knows what land they're standing on, can say a couple words in their language. You do that if you go to any country. You go to that country, you know who they are. You know you're in France. You know you're in France as opposed to China. You make that decision. You know you're there. You learn a few words in their language. It's just respectful. And so I would hope you could teach your little people to do the same thing, because they are living in someone else's country on a sovereign nation. And so you need to know whose it is and be respectful. I was on Facebook recently and someone mentioned Maria Tallchief. They'd gone through an arts education at Barnard College as a dancer and performer. They spent an entire quarter on George Balanchine and never once mentioned Maria Tallchief. She was his wife. She was the first prima ballerina of any race in the United States of America. She was an inspiration for some of the most famous ballets in his repertoire. Never mentioned the woman once. I mean, that's intentional. That's intentional erasure. And that's just not acceptable anymore. Never was, but definitely isn't now.
As a matter of fact, Jody noticed that you are wearing a Maria Tallchief shirt. She wanted to know, who are some artistic icons that you look up to and you perhaps want to emulate or you're inspired by?
Yeah, actually, Maria Tallchief was I was a classical ballet dancer before. Yes. I was, and a Balanchine dancer before I was a playwright. And Maria Tallchief was actually the reason that I believed I could do that. I saw her in a book. I had been given a book about successful women, like scientists and whatever. And one of them, I opened this page and there was Maria Tallchief. And I was like, oh my goodness, she's half Native American, half white. She lives in Oklahoma, just about as middle of nowhere as South Dakota. Mm-hmm. And she became a ballerina. And I thought, well, that means that's a real thing. And I can do that too. I was in ballet at the time. And I'd never seen a ballet. And yet by seeing that book and seeing her represented there made me in the middle of the prairie believe that this was something I could do. And I did.
Well, this really has been so much fun sharing this evening. And I guess one final thing before I let you go, when you think, Larissa, about the kinds of criticisms we hear of Black History Month, where it's like, okay, 4 weeks talking in very broad strokes about Black leaders while school textbooks are glossing over the horrors of slavery, and then we move on. How do you think we can do better for Black history, for National Native American History Month? I mean, how can it become more than window dressing?
Honestly, I mean, we're in a very different place as far as Native American Heritage Month and Black History Month, in that kind of, I'd say 90% of this country doesn't celebrate it or acknowledge it. So I think we'd be thrilled to be.
Got a ways to go to get there.
Yeah, we're not even in the window. And it's been a thing for like 40 years. I don't even know, maybe more. I don't even know my history. It's been for as long as I've been around. So this is a thing. It's a national thing. And so I would love everyone just to start there. We just need to start there. We're in a very different place than the African-American folks in this country, as far as our representation and people acknowledging that we're here and that they're, you know, on our land, and that, you know, people are all, I'm right now not on my own land. I'm on someone else's lands that have been taken from them. And it's the Tongva Keech Gabrielino people, and on the border of the Chumash people. And I'm always looking for ways to, how can I repay that? You know, so we all have to first acknowledge that we're on just that. That would be huge in America, to just acknowledge we're on stolen land. And then now, what can I do to pay something back, to pay back part of that debt? And so I think about that every day. How do I pay back the debt to these people? And I do a lot of things, both through my work and my personal life, as I'm capable, to constantly try to pay back the people on whose land I'm standing. And so that's, you know, I think a way forward for all of us that would be meaningful and true and real. And if we all started doing that, have a completely different country and a completely different relationship to our history that's shared together on this continent.
Well, you've given us so much to think about between watching your play and then having this conversation with us. Larissa Fasthorse, thank you so much for being with us. And we want to thank everyone, the whole bunch of you who joined us tonight. Thank you so much. This has been so fun. And everybody, stay safe, stay healthy. And we will all look forward to being together in person again when we come through this. Thank you so much, Larissa.
Thank you, Cindy. It's been great.
That was Larissa Fasthorse talking with Cynthia Canty, and you're listening to the National Writers Series from Interlochen Public Radio. Coming up in the second half, a discussion with thriller writer Ruth Ware.
You're listening to the National Writer Series from Interlochen Public Radio. I'm Doug Stanton, founder of the year-long book festival held in the City Opera House in Traverse City, Michigan. Ruth Ware says the most interesting thing about her is her books. She writes psychological crime thrillers, but says her own life is mundane and peaceful. Ruth's latest novel is One by One. She spoke with fellow author Megan Miranda at a virtual National Writer Series event, and Megan asked Ruth to talk about her new book.
Yeah, so One by One is set in a luxurious chalet in the French Alps in this super exclusive resort called Saint-Antoine, which is entirely fictional, but people who know the Alps well will probably realize that it bears a few similarities to the resort Val d'Isère, which I know quite well. It's my first novel that I've ever written with two narrators, which felt like a big change for me. It was something I kind of took a while to get used to. But the first narrator is Erin, and she's like the chalet hostess. So she's in charge of making everybody comfortable, along with her co-worker, Danny, the chef. And the other narrator is Liz, who is the secretary to this company, Snoop, who have taken over the chalet for a corporate retreat. And you find out very quickly that Snoop is there because they've been offered this enormous buyout offer, which has the potential to make the shareholders millionaires. But the company's completely split, and half the shareholders want to accept the buyout offer, and the other half of them want to reject it and retain control of the company. And Liz is caught in the middle because she was secretary at the firm way back when it started and has this tiny 2% shareholding, which has ended up in the position of having a casting vote. So they're all locked up together in the chalet, and poor Liz is under enormous pressure from all sides, and Erin is looking at this company and sort of thinking that they're all, you know, entitled kind of nightmare guests. And they go out for what's supposed to be this day of kind of R&R in the snow. And one of the founders and CEOs goes missing in the snow. And while they're trying to figure out what's happened and whether it's an accident or if she's just got lost, an avalanche descends on the chalet. So basically things go from bad to worse. And now they're all shut up together and they can't get away. And obviously people start dying.
Yes, I mean, I just, you know, there are so many layers of tension in this story because it starts with a very tense premise in and of itself that there's this corporate retreat and two people have very opposing views of how things should go forward. And then there's an avalanche and, you know, then there's the danger keeps closing in. So it was just absolutely brilliant. I wondered if you would share a bit of the book, a small reading, if you have.
I would love to. I'll do a really, really quick one. And it's actually, normally when I read from the beginning, but I'm going to read a tiny bit from quite a long way through the novel. So this is one of Liz's sections, and you'll see which part it is when I start. I'm upstairs in my room, changing out of my skiing clothes when it happens. At first, it's just a noise, and then I feel the ground begin to shake like an earthquake. I turn to the window. I see what looks like a wall of snow coming down the valley towards us, but not a wall. That implies something solid. This is something else, a boiling mass that is air and ice and earth all rolled into one. I scream. I do the only thing I can, even though it's stupid. I fall to my knees with my arms over my head, as if that pathetic gesture might protect me. I stay there shaking for a long time before I dare to get up, my legs trembling. Did it miss us? Did it stop? So obviously that's the point where the avalanche hits.
Oh, it's such a great moment. Thank you so much. So I know you mentioned this app, and I would love to talk with you more about this because when I started reading, I actually Googled to see if it was a real thing because it feels like a real app, definitely. And I'm fascinated by how it came about. If you could tell us also what it is for those of us who haven't read it. And also, you know, I just loved how you used it structurally as well, you know, not just throughout the plot, but even to begin each chapter heading. It was really, really cool. So could you tell us about Snoop?
Well, so creating Snoop was probably the most fun I had out of the whole book. So I knew that I wanted to write a book about a corporate retreat. That was kind of the seed of the inspiration because I'd done books about, you know, romantic love and relationships and friendships and families and all the kind of toxic dynamics that can build up in those situations. And I realized that the one relationship that I hadn't ever really looked at was the relationship that we have with our colleagues, which, you know, for most of us is a pretty formative one, not for writers who work at home, obviously, like we have that with our cats. But, you know, I spent most of my life working in an office in a day job, and those people became my friends and they were my support. And, you know, but anybody who has ever had a bad boss will tell you that it can also be an incredibly destructive relationship. So I knew that I wanted to write a book that explored both sides of that. So I decided I was going to write a book about a corporate retreat, and I knew that I wanted to set it at a ski resort because I love skiing and it felt like a really atmospheric place to set a locked room mystery. But then I was stuck with thinking, well, what kind of company would have the resources to go to such a luxurious place for their corporate retreat? And I thought a bit about finance and kind of hedge funds and investment firms, but I wasn't super interested in those as companies, and I don't know very much about that world. And then I thought, I reckon a tech company would do it, like a dot-com startup who had a lot of money and was used to splashing it around. So I thought, okay, my company is going to be an app. At which point, obviously, I had to invent an app, which turned out to be really quite hard. So I sat down, and this took about a week or more, and I kept having these, what I thought were brilliant ideas for apps. And then, of course, exactly as you did, I would Google and discover, unfortunately, this was already a real app, so that wouldn't do. And I knew that this company was going to be pretty vile, so I didn't want it to bear any resemblance to a real one, just in case I got sued. And eventually, I came up with this idea for an app, a music app, which I thought would be kind of cool because it, like, people's musical taste gives you lots of insights into who they are. And the premise of Snoop is that you take your Spotify or your Apple Music or whatever you listen to, and you hook it up to this app, and it makes your listening public. So anybody can log in and hear what you are listening to, like beat for beat in real time. But the quid pro quo is that you can then snoop on all of the other users who might be your best friend or your boyfriend or, you know, Lady Gaga or Beyonce or whoever is on there and has chosen to identify themselves on the app. And Snoop advertises itself as voyeurism for your ears. And I love that kind of that trade-off that we all make in the 21st century between entertainment and convenience, but also privacy. And that's something that Snoop are wrestling with and is kind of discussed in the book.
Yeah, I was actually, as you were just speaking, it reminded me of this. I feel like there's a little bit of a common thread in several of your recent books about technology, where the turn of the key is a smart house that, I mean, it's very convenient, but it turns very unsettling as well. And so were you kind of thinking about the pros and cons of technology as you were writing? Is that like a theme you're interested in exploring as well? I think it's really interesting to think about what we give up.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I guess I just come out of writing The Turn of the Key. So I was already kind of in that headspace of sort of thinking about the kind of the Faustian bargain that we make with technology. And, you know, it's like they always say, if you're not paying for a piece of software, you are paying for it. You're just paying for it in information instead of in money. And so many of the apps that we're all addicted to are completely free. And what they're trading in is the information that we're giving them. And on the one hand, we love it. You know, we love that when we Google restaurants, Google throws up ones that are close to us and doesn't, you know, bother telling us that something in, you know, Lewes, Delaware is amazing when we live in Lewes, Sussex, in my case. We know, you know, we rely on that because otherwise search engines would be unusable. But we also feel deeply creeped out when we walk into a store and then 10 minutes later we're getting adverts for it on our phones. So we're still, you know, as consumers, we're still figuring out how we feel about that. And the app companies are grappling with it too. You know, you see Facebook constantly trying to make itself look less creepy and less stalkery because they're aware that people feel weird about that. So anything that is in flux and that people are uncomfortable about is, I think, you know, inherently interesting to us as crime writers.
Definitely. And I love how, you know, at this, you alternate narrators chapter by chapter, and at the start of each kind of say, you know, who they're snooping on sometimes, but also there's that flip side that someone is snooping on them, can be snooping on them as well, or listening to what they're listening to. So it's really interesting. And I actually love to talk about the narrators some more as well, because, you know, there's this fascinating cast of characters. And I'm really interested in how you came about choosing the narrators for it, because for me as a reader, it was such a great way to see things from both the inside and the outside, because you have somebody who works at the chalet and somebody who's a part of the dynamics, although she's a little bit in the middle of things. And then as the avalanche comes, I feel like those lines get blurred even more between the staff and the visitors. So were those things you were thinking about when you were writing, and did that play into how you chose who would narrate it?
Well, originally when I started writing, I wrote it from Erin's point of view, the chalet hostess. And I picked her because I wanted an outside perspective on this company, because Snoop thinks that they're, you know, incredibly cool and incredibly hip, and they're, you know, the founders are super pleased with themselves. And I wanted someone who wasn't part of that world to kind of be looking at it and going, this dynamic is really screwed up. And Snoop are not good employers, you know, that's really important to say from the outset. And I, one of the things that I stumbled on when I was researching the book was the way that tech startups in particular can kind of go from 0 to 60 in, you know, a year, if that, and someone who has no experience of people management can suddenly find themselves in charge of a staff of, you know, 10, 20, 50 people with all of the kind of the headaches that that, in, you know, comes with. And a good CEO will educate themselves as to what makes a good employer or hire people who take care of that. And unfortunately, the people at Snoop are not interested in that side of things. So they've kind of allowed lots of toxic practices to build up in their company. And so I wanted someone who wasn't part of that dynamic to be kind of looking at it from the outside and sort of see them for who they were. But I got about 30,000 words into the book and something just wasn't working. And I sent it to my agent and she read it and agreed with me that it wasn't working, which was not the reaction that I wanted. But, you know, because she's a good agent, she was completely honest about it. And I went back to the drawing board and tried to figure out what the missing ingredient was. And I realized it was because she was too much of an outsider. And she was having to kind of listen at doors and overhear conversations in a way that was just, it wasn't really plausible because it wasn't in her character to do that. You know, she's not the kind of person who would snoop on people. Oh, I just realized I made a pun. and so I decided I needed another narrator and it needed to be someone who knew more about the inner workings of Snoop. But I guess I'm sort of intrinsically interested in outsiders and people who are kind of square pegs in round holes. So I picked someone who is an insider at Snoop. She's been there from day one, although she's since resigned for reasons you don't immediately find out. But she's also an outsider. You know, she's never really fitted in to this corporate culture. She's not super well off in the way that most of the other employees are. She's, you know, she's quite socially anxious. So she never feels that she's properly dressed or properly made up or the kind of person who should be in the room. And yeah, that was having the two of them together was huge fun. And at the beginning, it enabled me to give much more information about Snoop and its inner workings without having to kind of resort to these sort of slightly shoehorny methods. And as the book went on, I had so much fun showing the same event, show, you know, from two perspectives. And so you would get, you know, something happening and Erin would observe it. And then Liz would come in with a bit more knowledge about what was actually going on. And it was just fun saying to, you know, to the reader, you think this is what has happening, but actually this is what's happening. And that was, that was really enjoyable to write.
Yeah. As you were just answering that, I mean, I feel like that's something I think about a lot as well, as how you can have, you know, an event happens and people have completely different perspectives on it. And, you know, depending on your knowledge and your own experiences. So it was really so effective to read it that way, to be like, maybe this is the different perspective with this information. So kind of on that same topic, of what information you give. I really, really enjoyed and was fascinated by the start of the book, where you start with these corporate bios for everyone in Snoop, and they are hilarious and so spot on. And then right after that, you kind of contrast it with this article that says, that basically is talking about this accident and that a number of people end up dead. And there's this, you know, they're very different in tone. It's this juxtaposition. And it just, both of those set the scene so well, because as a reader, I felt like I was almost walking in with them and I knew something was coming. And I'm like, be careful, you don't know what's coming. So I was wondered kind of how you decide what information to give upfront, or how you come up with those decisions, and also those corporate bios. Did you kind of know those from the start, or did that kind of develop after you got to know the characters? Because I love them so much.
Oh, I had such fun writing those bios, as anybody who reads them can probably tell. So the book always began with the newspaper article. So there's a newspaper article right at the beginning. Actually, it's from an imaginary article from the BBC News website, saying that there's been an avalanche and that four people are dead, but you don't know which four. And that was in the book right from the beginning. And that was because I knew that the first death wasn't going to occur for a little while. And I sort of feel a responsibility as a crime writer to kind of to say to people, you know, don't worry, the crime's coming. There's definitely going to be a murder. Because otherwise, you know, I mean, I think people now know what to expect from my books. But definitely, you know, when the peril is a little way off, you want to sort of signal to people that bad stuff is around the corner. So that was in there right from the start. And I deliberately gave the number because I loved the idea of sort of having this quota and kind of playing with people's expectations of who might be in it and how many we've got to go until the quota's filled up. Hence the title, people are being picked off one by one. But the big challenge that I had when I was writing the book was, because it's a locked room mystery and because of the nature of the plot, all the guests descend right at the beginning. So you have a brief period where you get to meet Erin and Danny, who are the two chalet staff, and then all the members of Snoop, 10 of them, descend at the same time. And it was quite disorientating to write, so I can imagine it would be even more disorientating to read. And I was trying to sort of give the reader the information that they needed without sort of being too info dumpy, and give them tools to remember people without being too clunky. And in the end, I thought, I need a character list, which is something that I love about, you know, historical novels, when they have a long list at the beginning and you can sort of flick back and be like, oh, this is their place in the family tree. But just a bald list of names never really works for me as a reader. I don't have a peg to hang those people on, and it doesn't mean very much. So I thought I would do a kind of a found document to match the BBC News article. And I knew straight away that I wanted to take it off the Snoop website. And one of the things that, as a writer, I'm fascinated by is companies that have a really strong corporate voice. And you know the way there's some, it's like such a trend at the moment that you'll see it on like websites or labels even sometimes. And they'll have this kind of really sort of folksy voice. And sometimes it'll even extend to like the, you know, the ingredients, and it'll be like, oh, you know, no nasties. And it'll be like just a little, or, you know, alternatively, it'll be very techy and kind of. And I knew somehow that Snoop would be a company that would have a really annoying corporate voice. And so their biogs are really irritating, and hopefully it tells you everything that you need to know about them. And it also tells you which members of staff don't quite fit in, because there's a few who are just sort of like, yes, Carl went to law school and graduated with honours. You know, he doesn't fit in with the kind of the sort of tech bros tone. So yes, I had fun writing those.
Well, I had a lot of fun reading them, so thank you for that. No, it was so enjoyable. And as I was reading the start, I could just immediately, I knew so much about them just from that bio even. I felt like I could connect with their personalities. So it was really, really cool. So you actually mentioned locked room mysteries, which was actually something I was going to ask you for my next question. Because as I was reading, it felt very timely to be reading this right now, even, you know, we're not traveling, but this sense that, you know, our worlds, the boundaries of our day-to-day worlds have been pulling in a little bit closer over the last 6 months. And so I love this locked room mystery. And I know this is something I love about so many of your books. You have, you know, the locked room of the party, of the bachelorette party in the woods, and a locked, you know, you're basically, you're cast as a cruise ship in A Woman in Cabin 10. So I was wondering kind of what drew you to locked room mysteries. If you kind of like having that constraint, those boundaries to have to work within?
I don't know. I keep coming back to it as a theme. And on the one hand, I'm kind of making life deliberately hard for myself, because when you have a locked room mystery, you're right, you do have constraints. You can't solve things by having experts dropped in, and you know, you don't have a convenient detective to figure stuff out. So you really give your characters a tough time in resolving the mystery. I think as a writer, it makes me more creative, and it makes me dig down into the characters much more, because when you only have a really small, finite cast of characters, you have to get to know them really well. And also, I think specifically as a crime writer, there's something about kind of friction and conflict between characters that keeps me turning the pages when I'm reading, and it's fun to write. And as an introvert, the quickest way I know of creating kind of tension and conflict is to put lots of people into an uncomfortable situation together and then tell them that they can't get away. You know, that's the one thing that's guaranteed to make me start sweating, if I'm in a situation where I can't just call a cab and flee and get away. So I guess it's an easy way to sort of up the tension and up the friction. But it was weird. I wrote this book like last year and finished it, I guess it would have been sort of around November, December time. So, you know, coronavirus was not even a blink in the eye at that point. But I edited quite a lot of it under lockdown. And that was a weird experience, because it's very much that sort of, your world is getting smaller and smaller, and you're inhabiting this kind of claustrophobic scenario. So I'm quite glad that it's coming out now, when we're not under quite such strict lockdown conditions.
So since you were editing it during that time, did you feel like it was giving you different type of insight because of, like, into isolation? Did it change anything as you were writing?
No, I mean, I didn't change anything in the book because of it, but I definitely felt more sympathy for my characters. I think the key thing is, though, that, you know, I was lucky that I was locked down with my family, who I adore, and, you know, was generally having a pretty good time. But as Liz says in the book, you know, where they're stuck is this amazing location. It's incredibly beautiful. The chalet is really luxurious. Everything's perfect apart from the people that she is stuck with. So she's very much, you know, of the Jean-Paul Sartre, hell is other people kind of. And I did get to thinking about that as I was writing the book. I was thinking about, you know, all the people who are locked down with family that they can't stand, or friends that they've had an argument with. And it definitely made me very sympathetic to everybody who was having a difficult lockdown.
Yes, definitely. And I think, you know, I love when settings are, you know, there's these beautiful settings, but it really does come down to your experiences at the setting, or the people that you're with at these settings. And I think that's also something I can see now looking back as, like, thematically in several of your books, that they are these, you know, really idealistic or really nice places to visit, and then, you know, doesn't mean they're going to be a great place.
It's a bit wrong, exactly. Well, I think, you know, that's one of the things that I take inspiration from Agatha Christie for, because she does that so well, you know, that kind of sense of stifled luxury where she leads you into what should be the perfect kind of, you know, scenario of the luxurious Orient Express, or a beautiful dahabeah on the Nile, or, you know, an exclusive island hotel. And then she kind of picks and picks and picks at the surface and reveals this kind of, you know, seething mass of emotion and darkness beneath.
Yes. And that's actually, I was going to ask you another question about Agatha Christie. This is perfect time. So I know your books have in the past been compared to the great Agatha Christie, and One by One does feel very modern, but there is obviously kind of a feel to And Then There Were None. So is this something you took inspiration from as well in developing this idea, or in several of your books?
Well, the Christie comparison kind of surprised me initially, and that I wrote in a dark, dark wood without having sort of, you know, wasn't really consciously thinking about influences. But if I was, it was probably much more the sort of, you know, Wes Craven kind of, you know, Scream and Killer in the Woods kind of idea. But as soon as it came out, people started to say, oh, you know, it's like a modern day Agatha Christie. And I could absolutely see why, because I think I do try to create a puzzle in the same way that Christie does, and to have that kind of click moment of the pieces slotting in. So The Woman in Cabin 10 was me kind of tipping my hat to Christie more consciously, I guess, because, you know, I was very grateful to her for having provided a template for, you know, the perfect crime novel, and for me riffing off that in A Dark, Dark Wood. And so with The Woman in Cabin 10, I sort of tried to pay homage to her a bit more obviously, in a way. And then I kind of strayed away a little bit. The Lion Game is a very different book. It's, you know, much more about friendship and school. The Death of Mrs. Westaway is probably my thank you to Daphne du Maurier, who I also love and is a stone cold psychological thriller writer. The Turn of the Key is obviously a debt of inspiration to Henry James. And One by One is, yeah, it's probably me coming full circle and coming back to my Christie-ish roots. And yeah, definitely And Then There Were None was an inspiration. In fact, if Christie hadn't stolen that title, I probably would have wanted to have it. But it's in no way a rewrite. I've seen sort of some suggestions on social media that it is, and it's not. Oh, I don't want to mislead anyone in that respect. It doesn't have the same themes or the same premise, but yeah.
Yeah. So thank you so much, Ruth. This was so fun chatting with you, and thank you to National Writers Series for having us and for everyone for joining. And I love this. I feel like every new book of yours is like my new favorite Ruth Ware book. So thank you so much. I love chatting with you.
Oh, thank you for all the brilliant questions, Megan. And if anybody hasn't read The Girl from Widow Hills, do, but don't tell me who done it, because I'm still waiting to find out. So.
Thanks.
Bye, everyone.
That was Ruth Ware talking with Megan Miranda. Ruth's latest book is called One by One. In the first half of the program, we heard from Larissa Fasthorse talking with Cynthia Canty. Larissa wrote The Thanksgiving Play and other works for the stage. Learn more about the National Writers Series and upcoming events at nationalwritersseries.org, and listen to past programs at interlochenpublicradio.org. For Interlochen Public Radio, I'm Linnea Melkerich.